Hello, this is Julian Carr, and you are listening to the Snow Brains Podcast.
Welcome to the Snow Brains Podcast, where it's my job to interview the most intelligent people in the snow sports industry and pass their fascinating knowledge on to you, our listeners. I'm your host, Miles Clark. I'm a professional free skier, a professional mountain guide, a UC Berkeley molecular cell biology graduate, the founder and CEO of Snow Brains. And when I was in seventh grade, two of my best buddies and I thought it would be a great idea to take a small pickup truck in the driveway for a joyride. With the two of them in the front and me in the back of the pickup, we ripped around a local street. When we came back to the house, we all agreed it was too damn fun, and we did it again. This time, when ripping up a sketchy mountain road, the back right tire went into a ditch and the axle hit the pavement. We lost control of the truck and slammed into a monstrous old oak tree. We were okay, but the truck was so damaged that the bed no longer lined up with the cab by about a foot. We pushed the pickup back to the house and awaited our fates. The guy driving became a Navy SEAL. The kid in the passenger seat became a professional basketball player. I was grounded for a year and sent to private school for eighth grade. Brutal. Today's Snow Brains Podcast is brought to you by Killington. Make the most of any spring weekend. Head to Killington, the East Coast's biggest mountain resort. The Beast of the East has everything you need to enjoy a winter getaway. From the best ski and snowboard terrain to one-of-a-kind dining options and fabulous après-ski experiences. Vacation packages are available now. Visit Killington.com to learn more. Today's Snow Brains Podcast is brought to you by A Golden State, the California leader in premium cannabis flower. Born in Northern California under the watch of the Cascade Mountains, A Golden State's plants are hand-watered with snowmelt from Mount Shasta and sustainably grown in their own carbon-neutral hydroelectric cultivation facility. My guest today is Julian Carr. Julian is a professional free skier who regularly hucks 100-foot cliffs, including two world record cliff jumps to his name, one of which was over 200 feet. Julian won the George Mallory Lifetime Achievement Award in 2021. He's won an X Games gold medal. Julian came in third place once in Powder Magazine's most influential skier poll. And Julian is a businessman. Julian founded Discreet Clothing in college, and it has flourished into a very successful brand. Julian also founded the Cirque Series 6 years ago, and it has become the premier mountain running event in the USA and North America, spanning seven mountains each summer. Julian's latest business, Blake Bronco, is centered around fixing up 1978 and 79 Ford Broncos and selling them. Julian is a fascinating human being who changed the ski industry forever. Hello, Julian. Welcome to the show. Thanks so much for being here. How are you, man?
I'm doing awesome. Thanks so much for having me on.
Well, I love it. Yeah, especially after hearing you just got back from touring in Colorado. That's damn cool. I usually ask, when did you ski last? And your answer is like an hour ago. I love that. So, Julian, you've done a hell of a lot with your life. Today, I really want to dig into your professional skiing career, your cliff jumping, your businesses, and more. So we'll start off with some rapid fire questions and we'll jump into some of your deeper stuff. Sound fun?
Sounds great, man. Let's get it on.
Let's do it, man. Here we go. So how many days do you ski per year?
You know, I'd say these days I'm probably flirting in the 80 to 100. I think for probably, you know, a good decade plus, I was definitely 100 to 150 plus.
Nice. What's your biggest accomplishment in skiing?
Being happy and healthy. We are also lucky to ski and to kind of do the impossible. Be happy and healthy, man. That is just such a huge accomplishment. And I'll definitely put that feather in my cap.
And I'm going to remember you saying do the impossible because there's not many people that can do what you do on skis. What's your biggest accomplishment in life?
Really just following my interests. I think that I've been lucky to be insulated by amazing people. Making a career year-round in the outdoors is certainly something I'm proud of. And I'd probably say, you know, it's pretty up there for, you know, we talk about what you're happy about in your life.
How do you define yourself?
I don't know, man. I'm always drawn to like simple complexities, like a well-drawn maze. I'll leave it at that.
I love that. I like that. Where's your favorite place to ski?
Alta, Utah or Snowbird, Utah, just Little Cottonwood Canyon, any of the Cottonwood Canyons, Brighton Solitude, backcountry, doesn't matter, on a deep pow day.
I love it, the Wasatch. And if you had to expand that to maybe a couple more mountain ranges, what would be your favorite?
You know, I got to say Engelberg, Switzerland is definitely up there with Alta. And I mean, everywhere is so amazing. It's probably like asking, you know, a parent who their favorite kid is, because you go to the Andes. And the Andes Mountains are so interesting because there's culture shock, but there's mountain shock down there because the mountains are just so different. They're so ancient and kind of unfriendly at first. So it's kind of it's just a trip to go to Japan, to go to Alaska. Like every place has its own kind of unique personality and mountain shock. And I love being exposed to that because it's fun to, you know, look at, when you just have to like read Braille, it's like a whole new experience, a whole new world to immerse yourself in because you're used to different mountain ranges, different snowpacks. So the short answer to all that is definitely Little Cottonwood Canyon and Engelberg, Switzerland are my favorites.
I'm going to remember that mountain shock. I love that because that is what gets me the most high. You know, when you go somewhere totally new and it's just crazy and wild and you don't know what to expect, you know, that's usually when I have the most fun, to be honest. And that same thing happened to me when I went to the Andes for the first time. What would you do if you couldn't ski?
Man, you know, it's a trip is that I started skiing in eighth grade and sixth, seventh grade, my dad almost took a job in New York City. He found a nice position doing some research at the University of Utah for computer science in the PhD department. And he stayed.
Nice.
But he did say yes to a job in New York City and we were like going to move there. So I've often thought about that, like, wow, that would have been such a different life. And I'd be really interested to see what I'd get into. I think I've always been fascinated by business, just creativity.
What scares you the most in the mountains?
When you hear about and you see and you know good friends or very well-known, very smart, very calculated people that make great decisions that have bad accidents and either perish or whatever. So that's usually the scariest thing to me is when you see the Shane McConkeys and the Doug Coombs and so on that don't make it out. And they're great decision makers, very talented. We all, you know, are at the mercy of the mountains are really gnarly. They're really extreme. So I think that's what scares me most is just knowing that great decision makers can get taken out too.
It's a great answer because I think we've all had friends that have passed away too. And you know, the objective danger of the mountains is always there. And at some point it is kind of a numbers game. You know, the more you expose yourself to the mountains, the more chance you have of having something objective take you out. And that's a question I always like to ask our guests too. I know it's very personal, but how many friends may you have lost in the mountains?
You know, too many. I think the closest friend I've had that didn't make it was Billy Poole, 2009, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And he was one of my best ski buddies and him and I were skiing every day and really pushing each other. And it was really fun to finally identify and meet up with somebody that was very interested in the same things as I was on skis. And so him and I had a lot of really fun adventures and pushed each other. I'd maybe filmed with Warren Miller two or three times and he finally got his break and we were both shooting for Warren Miller. And at the time, it was when I was first starting up Discreet Clothing, and I brought him in as an equity. I gave him some equity, so we were going to go do our first trade show and in like 2 weeks. So there we were filming with Warren Miller together, talking about how we're going to do our first trade show. And then literally two runs later, I blew my ACL, PCL, LCL, meniscus, and tore my calf muscle. So I got completely taken out. I hit a tree, just skiing this line, came over a blind rollover. And the only thing I had left was my MCL. So anyway, I get taken out. 2 days later in Wolverine Cirque, Billy skis, you know, high speed, wild line. And he didn't make it. He hit some rocks and had some internal bleeding and that was really hard. And from there on, I've had plenty of peers and acquaintances that I certainly call friends that haven't made it, but I definitely had one of my best buds get taken out. So that was really tough.
That is brutal, man. Thank you for sharing that. I met Billy up at Mount Baker once in Washington, and he was a really, really cool person. Yeah, really cool person. Thank you for sharing that. What do you love most in the mountains?
I think the mystery, you know, every day is a mystery. You might have some expectations, and throughout the years I've learned to, you know, you can put a script together for best case scenario for what you want to do that day, but you can't latch on to those kind of expectations. So I think the mystery of it all, no matter what your intentions are, you just don't know what's going to happen that day. And I think that's why skiing is so refreshing. You know, I think that people that surf or engage with the ocean probably have a taste of that. I feel like mountains are just a little bit different because you actually get to travel so deep in them and explore all the little nooks and crannies and the people that you're with and the good times that you have and the inside jokes that happen. And every day is just a huge mystery, whether it's the physical part, the mental, or the friendships.
It's a very cerebral answer, man. I love where all this interview is going already. What's the funniest accident or funniest story you've had in the mountains?
I mean, there's so many, but the first one that comes to mind is I was out on a shoot in Montana, and you know how it is. You got to go to the bathroom, man. Like, so there I am going to the bathroom, and we're like trying to move to a new zone. So I got to make it fast and I get out of there. I'm trying to keep up with everyone. And then finally, my friend behind me is like, dude, look at the back of your skis, bro.
And no.
So I got clowned on that whole trip because I literally was like skiing for a couple of runs, like out in the backcountry, touring around, and I fully just like shit on my skis. It was great.
I love how often, poo comes into play in that answer with our guests. But that might be one of the best ones, man. What's the scariest accident you've had in the mountains?
You know, I mentioned blowing my knee, but a few years preceding that, I shattered my femur in 11 pieces. It was really, really gnarly. I thought for a moment, you know, my internal bleeding, because it broke just an inch down from where the femoral head attaches to your femur socket or to your hip socket. And so I was really scared because I didn't know if it was my hip and my femur or all the above. I didn't know, like everything. And so the first thing that went through my mind, because I had this really technical double line, and I actually aced the line earlier in the day. I came back to it, didn't focus. And at that point in my, where I was in skiing, it was like the first year I'd gained sponsors. I was in college just finishing. And I was like on top of the world as far as I was concerned. I was, you know, one of those guys that could just 99% of the time figure it out real time. And finally caught up to me. I couldn't figure it out. I didn't focus completely. I crashed. I went over the handlebars. I hit some rocks as I was crashing. And, you know, immediately I could tell it impacted like what felt like my ass. And I was like, ooh, I just bruised my ass. And I flipped over. Or when I crashed, I was face first.
Oh.
And I immediately grabbed my ass and I was like, oh my God, I just fucked my, like, I just, ooh, ouch, you know? So I flip over on my back and my boot is up by my head.
No.
And my leg is a wet noodle draped across my body.
No.
And so, yeah. And I didn't freak out. I was like, you are so hurt that you need to remain calm and help yourself here. So I grabbed my leg, like wet noodle, full, my whole leg is a wet noodle, like plopped it down in the snow and packed snow underneath it. The first thing that went through my mind, obviously within those 10 seconds of that act, was once I set my foot down where it should be, I was like, move your toes. And I could. So I was like, oh, sweet. I'm not paralyzed. And then I was like, well, if I start losing consciousness right now, it means I have really bad internal bleeding. I'm probably going to die right now. And luckily I stayed alert and I was like, okay, sweet. It looks like I avoided that as well. Anyway, they took me down. The x-rays showed in the MRI that I had multiple bone fragments that were within, you know, a millimeter nicking my femoral artery. Quite amazing that I made it through that. But that experience, and we can get into it later maybe, but it enabled me to be a great decision maker because I knew that I did not want to get that hurt again. So it was definitely the worst injury, definitely the scariest thing that's ever happened to me on snow. And through it all, gave me amazing insight and wisdom that, you know, as those cliches it sounds, you know, I'm glad it happened.
I strongly believe in what you're saying. So but I do want to get into it now, but really quick, how old were you? It sounds like you were in college, but, and where was this?
It was actually at Snowbird.
Okay.
And yeah, it was the first year I had sponsors, and I was in my last year of college, and I took like my preseason training so seriously that year. I was skiing so well, felt so good on my skis. I'd never skied better. And it's just classic overconfidence. You know, I did the line earlier in the day, aced it, came back to it. I had some buddies with me that, you know, were badasses, and I just wanted to flex on them. It was actually the first day of the year. So it was the kind of line that I would not normally have done until, you know, a couple months into a season, but I was just feeling so good. And yeah, so that overconfidence slapped me into reality, and it was a great lesson.
Yeah. And tell us how that changed your perspective and changed the way that you approach the mountains.
Well, you know, after getting that hurt and spending full time in physical therapy to get healthy again and to get full mobility, full strength, all that happened from that, because that happened Thanksgiving weekend. The doctor was like, well, you might not ski for a couple of years. You got, you know, this is pretty serious, because the where the bone fragments are and where it broke so high up in that area, there's so many bone attachments, muscle attachments, that this is pretty tricky. So he's like, things got to go really well with my surgery, number one, to not disrupt all your muscle attachments. And then as you're healing, you know, things need to calcify so that all those muscle attachments are like firing at 100%. Otherwise your mobility or your strength, or there's so many things that this makes this really complicated. So he did a great job on his surgery. I lived and breathed physical therapy, and I actually skied that spring. I skied some groomers, which was awesome. And then as the next winter came around, so obviously having a whole year pass me by, and then having to mentally climb back in the arena, I just made a promise to myself, because I was like, okay, well, if you're going down this road, which I knew I wanted to, you need to be what you're about to do. If there's even a 1% anything, or if a hair on your body doesn't, is there's just something you're not quite well thought about, if like, just if there's anything, you just don't do it, like do not do it. And that was great, because up to that point I was like all of us, we look down a line, and I'm sure we all just are like, should work out. And so I just like ditched that, because we can, as skiers, it's crazy that we can usually real time figure things out, or you end up with some amazing cartwheels or whatever, and you can laugh it off. And finally, I didn't laugh that one off, almost took me out. And throughout the next few years, as I got, you know, back on my feet and started skiing hard again and making good decisions, I just got fascinated with cliffs. I already loved catching air. Ever since I was a little kid, I did a lot of gymnastics. I loved the foam pit. Obviously, I started skiing in eighth grade, and as soon as I started skiing powder, instantly I was like, oh, okay, powder, the mountains are just like a gigantic version of a gymnastics foam pit. And throughout those years, you know, I got up to 40, maybe 50 foot cliffs, and that's huge. It's gigantic. And after that injury, for whatever reason, I was very interested in going bigger. I was really wanting to wrap my head around it. And at the time, that's when Jamie Pierre was at the top of his game. And so every TGR movie that came out, just about every powder free skier or freeze that came out, there was another photo of him going over 50 feet, if not 100. So I was like, if Jamie can crack the code, I can, you know? And so through those 2 or 3 years after that injury, I just kept focusing on how he did that. And finally, I kind of had a aha moment. And I was like, you know what? When I'm in the air on a 50 footer, I might be in the air for a second at best. And I'm like, in that 1 second, you have to be supremely composed. You have to know exactly where you're landing. You need to know exactly what the snowpack is doing. And I'm like, I put so much thought into a 50 foot cliff. I'm like, if I can just be composed for another like 0.5 seconds with how much more airtime I'm going to be falling at that speed, that 0.5 seconds should probably equate to like another 40 or 50 feet. So I'm like, I can double what I've been hitting if I can just be composed for another 0.5 seconds. So finally, that kind of really resonated in my mind and in my bones and in my spirit. And the next year, sure enough, we had 2 or 3, 4 years in Utah where it snowed so much. And finally had the opportunity. I was up skiing Sunrise with Adam Clark and Rob Holmes. We skied these beautiful Sunrise POW shots up off of Cardiff. And the snow is super deep. There's tons of base. And we keep skiing down. We're like on the Looker's Right at Hellgate across the street from Alta, upper Looker's Right. And there's like a few, you know, chunks of those big gray cliffs. And sure enough, I pull up and I look off this one, and it's got to be 80, 90 feet. And all the alarm bells went off, like we all do, with fear. It was like, hell no. That's so scary. Ain't going to happen. And I was like, well, if you want to do these big cliffs, like, now's the time. Like, you're not going to find deeper snow, better conditions, and a really awesome crew that will have amazing safety and perspective and patience. So probe the landing, I mean, beyond good to go. Get up there, I start making the end run, and I like pull up and look off the end again, and just heart rate's going crazy, super scared. I'm like, next time, next cliff, the next one. And I almost pointed my skis down to go meet up with the crew and be like, oh yeah, the next one, just something was off. Right. But I was like, you know what? If you're going to do these big cliffs, if you're this interested in them, they're never going to be not scary. They're right. Always going to be scary. I knew that moment. I was like, you need to stare down the barrel right now and face this fear and think through this. Like, you need to stay up here and breathe through this, breathe through the fear, and wrap your head around the possibility. Don't wrap your head around if it's scary or not. Just wrap your head around the possibility. So I was able to like kind of use all that fear to like, you know, critically think about what I was going to do. And as I did that, it was very interesting because I started breathing really calm. I started having these amazing visualizations of what I was going to do. And this fear like genuinely turned into confidence. And I was almost like in this hyper present state and like almost meditation. And I got to the point where I kept thinking through it. And I knew that physically, mentally, spiritually, all that fear 100% got converted into confidence. And it was interesting because I was very lucid and present and talking to everybody, but I had the supreme relaxation and supreme confidence that I knew I was going to be okay. And I knew I had the skills. I knew I had the physical capabilities. I knew the snow I was going to land in was good. I like suddenly felt a part of my environment. I could feel like, you know, the electromagnetic spectrum that were a part of my skis, the sky, the cliff, the snow. I felt connected to it all. And I was very calm and I was like, I'm ready and I'm going to do this. And I know I'm going to be okay. Well, this very bizarre transfer of something I'd never experienced on skis before. It was like this whole another level of awareness. And I shit you not, I'm about a minute out, you know, call down the radio, tell the crew I'm going to do it. I'm ready. And they're fired up and they're getting everything ready to go. And of all people, Jamie Pierre pulls up. Up until Jamie Pierre in the big cliff game, there had been maybe four or five guys that had done a 100-foot cliff in that range. And all of them maybe had done it once or twice. So suddenly Jamie Pierre comes along. Not only did he do it once or twice, he's doing it dozens of times.
Right.
And he just flipped the script on the big cliff game. Unlike anybody had ever seen or done until him. He was literally just this complete outlier that didn't make any sense, but I was dedicated to figuring out how he pulled it off. And so in that moment where I finally got in on the secret, he pulls up and we're talking back middle of the backcountry, you know, don't really see anybody around, especially in the zone we were in. And suddenly he just pulls right up right on my end run. And he's like, hey man. And he sees what I'm about to do. And he like realizes it's a pretty big cliff. And to his credit, he just instantly was like, backs up. And cause he could tell I was like pretty much ready to go. And he's like, hey, this is awesome. He's like, do you mind if I hit it after you? And I was like, absolutely. So I get my wits, you know, back to task at hand, call down the radio, fully calm. Didn't matter that Jamie Pierre was standing right there, just completely focused, completely confident in what I was going to do. And, you know, obviously when you visualize and you have this epiphany, this aha moment, is there nothing like it when you actually have to do it? So count down the 10 seconds, I'm off. And as soon as I get out in the air and I see how far away the ground is, it was like a time warp. And it always is with big cliffs, because you see how far away the ground is and it's like a timeout with like time. It doesn't make any sense, because you have these like amazing, fully thought out thoughts, many of them that go through your mind and your body in a split second. Anyway, I'm supremely relaxed when I come in contact with the snow, and I did not feel anything. And as I went through the snow and kind of like relaxed my body, I got my skis back underneath me as I kind of just distributed the impact across my whole body, you know, and suddenly I'm skiing away and I pull off to the side, and, you know, then some adrenaline comes and everyone's hooting and hollering. And it was so crazy, because I knew up on top of that cliff, I was like, I was 100%. And I knew I'd be doing a disservice to myself if I didn't do it. Cause I was like, you promised yourself, if you weren't 100% about something, you wouldn't do it. I'm like, so you're beyond 100% and you need to do it, because that's what you promised yourself. So if you're going to honor yourself, you're going to do this. And anyway, when I landed and didn't feel a thing, cause I was supremely relaxed, it was the highest I'd ever jumped by, you know, 30, 40 feet. And I had total relaxation, tight body throughout the air, perfect center of gravity. And when I skied and landed, skied away without feeling a thing, instantly I was like, oh boy, there is no limit on how big you can go. So a great like affirmation to what set me on my journey throughout my career now, really started with that one cliff of just facing the fear. And there's never been ever any cliff, whether it's 30 feet or 200 plus feet, that it's not super scary. But it's the ability to, you know, funnel that fear into critical thinking and utilizing it. Because as you do start to critically think, most often things don't line up and you go, you're out of there. You know, thousands of cliffs I wanted to hit started going through that process, and it was either the takeoff or the landing or the trajectory or the sheerness, like something wasn't right as I sat down to really assess it. But, you know, there's been, I probably hit 20 plus cliffs over 100 feet in my life. Fear's very present. And fear's a great thing. You should definitely listen to it most of the time. But I learned that just because something's scary doesn't mean you can't do it. And it's been fun, because I think that's trickled into many aspects of my life off skis, which has been very rewarding to get enriched with this amazing mental space that I can access and just have that ability to sit with things and try to think through it all, instead of just, and even listen to it. Like I said, sometimes whatever that initial built-in kind of self-preservation, whatever it is, like, it's usually right. But if you can get through it, you can be rewarded heavily mentally and physically. It just depends on what you're interested in.
And that release, that adrenaline, that amazing feeling afterwards is hard to compare to when you have worked through Absolutely. The fear. I'm always looking for breakthrough moments, and that was clearly a breakthrough moment for you. If you're jumping an 80 foot to 90 foot cliff and you're basically thinking, oh, there's no limit now, I've now broken through. How old were you when that happened?
I didn't think about that. I think it was around 25 or 26.
That's awesome. And do you think having Jamie Pierre there might have gave you some comfort and maybe gave you, you know, hey, this is legit. Jamie also wants to hit this. I have confirmation. Did that help maybe?
I think it was a non-issue. It was like it didn't affect me one way or another, but I thought a very nice omen. And looking back, it was amazing, because actually on that cliff, like I said, Rob Holmes helped me probe that cliff. And he's the one that hit that that kind of blew people's minds right before Jamie got on the scene.
The OGs were there.
Obviously, yeah, they're both there for me. So a very nice omen.
Yeah. So, you know, talking about working through the fear, finding that focus, you know, and having that ability to work through all of that, You have two world records for cliff jumping. Could you tell us what those world records are?
Yeah. So like I said, after I hit that 80, 90 footer that year, when I did it, I instantly was like, oh, there is no limit there. It's I just knew it. I was like, it's so on. So, so the next winter comes around and one of Jamie's cliffs that he pioneered in Wolverine Cirque in Utah, it's in between Big and Little Cottonwood Canyon, but he found this 140 foot cliff back there that,
wow,
you know, I don't know if my eyes would have instantly gone to, but I was like, well, that's the biggest cliff in the Wasatch. I should probably go have a look. So it was, believe it or not, this is how big of a winter it was that next year, December 4th. I hit his Wolverine cliff on December 4th, and we had a laser pointer, and it was 175 feet that day.
Oh my God.
I was with my buddy JT Holmes, and he was really hyped on the cliff, and he wished he had his parachute with him. Cause he was just getting, he's like, dude,
that's a sign.
You have to do this cliff where I'll follow you and I'll throw my chute. So that's always been this idea that him and I've had, and he had his laser pointer. I wouldn't have had it. I would have thought the cliff was like around 140, but okay. He had his laser pointer, 175 feet. So wow. I do a straight air, and with the straight air, I nailed my balance and my timing and my composure. In the last like 20 feet of the air, the wind kind of grabbed my skis and started to adjust my control. I didn't have any anymore, but luckily I hit. I was still very relaxed. I landed just fine in a great position. But I told myself from that moment on, I was like, wow, you can never straight air a cliff that's like over 100 feet because you are at the mercy of what the wind can do to your skis. One time I hit like a 20 foot cliff at Snowbird, just on a big pow day, and we're rallying with the crew, and I hit this cliff, and like, it was so deep that I got shoveled underneath, like my skis popped up and my body shot underneath the snow, and I was like buried in my own bomb hole. And it took extreme effort and discomfort to get my mouth above the snow to breathe and then to get myself out of there. About a 20-minute self-rescue.
Whoa.
That was a very close call. Yeah. But I told myself from that moment on, I was like, wow, it doesn't matter how big a cliff is, you need to have somebody that can ski directly to you upon landing. But anyway, going back to the 175 footer, I was like, wow, you cannot do a straight air because your skis are going to get caught by that wind at some point. Luckily, I landed perfectly, skied away instantly, like bam, skiing away. And I was like, oh my God. I remember I started calling and texting some of my buddies that were skiing at Snowbird. And I was like, you guys are going to shit your pants because I just hit your Wolverine cliff. And people were like, what? So anyway, that winter, I ended up hitting that Wolverine cliff four times that winter. I did the straight
four times.
And then a couple. Yeah. And then in January, I did a front flip off of it. And that ended up being like the cover of Team 13's Echo. That was like my first movie I was ever in. I had the lead segment. So that whole year I started filming with Team 13. Yeah, I was really, really psyched. And like I said, it kept snowing. And then a month later in February, I did a backflip off that cliff. What I should say, as the snow started filling in and more storms kept coming in, we kept measuring it each time I hit it. And the time I did the front flip in January, it was 160 feet. And then when I did the backflip off of it, in February, it was down to 140 feet.
Whoa.
And then in April 1st of all days, April Fool's Day, I did, and I want to say it's an unofficial world record, but I did a spread eagle and I held it forever. And perfect center of gravity, spread eagle the whole way down. And that day it measured 110 feet. Then the very next winter, I went to Europe for my first time, and it was a blast. At the end of that trip on the last day, I was able to hit, you know, I said it was at least 210 feet. So I just called it 210 feet. But after watching like split screens of Jamie's cliff and my cliff, we're in the air the exact same amount of time. So
which is how much time?
I knew when I got off 4 seconds on the dot.
Wow.
So the biggest cliff I'd hit up to that point was 175 feet. And I thought the Engelberg cliff, when I hit it, because we'd been hitting cliffs like crazy in Engelberg, tons of 40 footers, 60 footers, the snow was so good. And then it just absolutely blizzarded for our last couple of days in town and went blue for our last day filming.
Nice.
I'd already been staring at this cliff the whole trip and figuring it out. So when that morning came, I'd already spent enough time, you know, meditating on how I'd do it, because the snow was already almost good enough to do it, but it wasn't quite there.
And anyway, what do you need? What's the threshold for the landing to hit a cliff like this?
You know, the landing needs to be like 30 degrees steep. It can't be too steep, because then you're going to, you know, just cause a slide, but it can't be obviously too flat. So this one was kind of just right. And then, you know, it needs to be a sheer cliff. I like cliffs that are sheer. And this one was interesting because, you know, in the best case scenario, you can manicure your takeoff, which gives you a lot of kind of practice and that kind of visualization to know exactly what to expect.
Right.
This Uber cliff, that was not the case. It was a very, very, very intense ski-in to it that you had to hit natural. And I had to ski in above some really exposed stuff in two different circumstances. It was so intense. I mean, it was so intense.
I just watched the clip, and a little bit that is shown in the video, it's like, you are just exposed, man.
Oh, so exposed. So anyway, when I got off that cliff, I was so happy to get to the exit zone, because getting down to it was so intense that as I was assessing the cliff and hanging out in Engelberg for those couple of weeks and hitting other cliffs and checking this one out, I thought it was around the size, maybe a little bigger than the Wolverine cliff. Anyway, as soon as I actually get out in the sky and I look down, you know, and have that split second moment of all those things that happened and the time warp, the ground was significantly further down. When we landed it, we didn't have a way to measure it, because there's no way you're going to get back on the top of it.
Like, no.
It was just so impossible to get back up there. But I was with Tom Ways, and he, you know, in the Tahoe area in the summer, he cuts down like problematic trees, or, you know, people that want trees gone or trees that are dead that need to come down. And so he's cutting down routinely 100 to 300 foot trees. And after it was done and said, I knew that there's no way it was smaller than 210 feet. That's why I was like, Tom, and we were with like our whole crew, all the locals. I was like, I have every confidence in my bone that this cliff is at least 210 feet. Can we call it 210 feet? Will you give me the Tom Ways stamp of approval? And he just looks at me and he's like, JC, that was at least 210 feet. That's what I've always called it. And since I did a front flip and Jamie did his straight air, he obviously has the biggest cliff ever hit at 250. My world record's just the biggest invert off a cliff at 210. But
wow.
Like I said, when you actually put us on split screen, my cliff was definitely more like 250, but I just always called it 210, because any cliff over 200 feet. And to me, it's baseball card stats. Like, I developed a relationship with that cliff in that moment. It was very spiritual. It was beautiful. And that's my intent. That's my pursuit. But, you know, obviously as you carry on with a career, you need to have those baseball card stats. So suddenly having a world record and having to put a number on it, those things become fun. They become kind of, it just feels that's not the pursuit. If you get my drift, you know, that's why I was always like, 210 is fine with me. But it's been funny as I've, you know, carried on in my career to be like, it is kind of crazy now that I'm like, wow, the reality of it is that was definitely like a 250 foot cliff.
Unbelievable, man. And just for our listeners, Tom Ways is a legendary Alaska heli ski guide and Tahoe person, just skis some of the most badass stuff in my book on earth. I need to get him on this show. He's a wild animal. 250 feet. All right. And so, I love the way you're talking about, you know, the air resistance, making a straight air not possible. Jamie Pierre really proved that. So I really want to get nerdy here for a second, because I just did a little research today and I learned that the human body generally hits terminal velocity at 120 miles an hour. So in general, the human body hits 120 miles an hour, our terminal velocity in about 3 to 5 seconds. So, I timed your jump today too, your 210 foot or 250 foot Switzerland jump today. And it was about 4 seconds exactly. So let's just be general and say you're going over 100 miles an hour probably when you landed. Do you think that's probably true?
Yeah, I think so. From hanging around like base jumpers enough that they have always had a consensus that you reach terminal velocity after somewhere in the 500 to 600 foot range. So if 120 is terminal velocity, which I don't know if that's the case, but if that's what you're saying, then yeah, I think I always thought I was probably going around 90 or 100. So it seems like that fits that equation pretty well.
So and you're talking about the thresholds being, you went about a 30 degree slope, and I didn't quite get what the threshold for depth was, but I'm imagining, you want 4+ feet of fresh snow. So you're going about 100, you hit the snow, you're going to rapidly decelerate. And we all know rapid deceleration is generally a really bad thing for the human body because we're pretty soft and squishy, but you seem to be totally fine. So after that, 250 foot air in Switzerland, how did you feel? What was did you feel the impact? How was your body feeling when you landed?
Well, this is where it gets, kind of hippie.
We'll go from nerdy to hippie.
Yeah, there we go. Obviously, when I do these things, I love living. I love life. I have so many interests off my skis that I'm aware of how ridiculous big cliffs are. But I also have this, relationship and this ability to get into this. This is where it gets hippie, is that I'm supremely relaxed. I'm supremely, in the state of consciousness that, like I told you, I feel like I'm already a part of the electromagnetic spectrum that's around me. So there is a non-impact. Anytime I've hit a cliff over 100 feet and I achieve that state of relaxation and being present and being a part of my surroundings, all I can say is that I'm so relaxed that when I'm falling through the air, when I flip my front flip over, when I actually hit the snow, there is no feeling of impact. I know it sounds crazy, but I'm supremely relaxed. I'm supremely already have a relationship with the snowpack because I've gone down there. I've spent hours probing it and laying in it and meditating and getting to know the layers in the snow. So I already know exactly what those 10 plus feet of snow is going to feel like when I hit it. So it is a bizarre, the only time I've ever seen or read anything similar is when I read like where monks can take themselves mentally, no matter where their surroundings are and where they can take their mind. I'm like, wow, I know that headspace. Obviously monks can just get into the headspace chilling cross-legged and I need to stare down the barrel of what should kill you cliffs, but I do achieve it and I don't feel a thing, man. I do not feel a thing and it does not hurt. I wouldn't do it if it hurt. And it's a very sacred kind of ritual for me. Every time I hit a big cliff, it's a very charged, I'm living. I'm so present. Like I said, you can say all the hippie cliche things, but it's real. And, when people like Bruce Lee talk about like how you need to, water needs to become the shape of the cup or be water or, that kind of crap. Uh-huh. Like crazy. Like, those hyper cerebral people that we read about, they do know an interesting headspace, and I've been fortunate enough to access it from time to time and do it in a manner that is ridiculous. Because when I'm in the moment and things are clicking and I do it, things are completely reasonable. Everything is totally reasonable. And then obviously after the moment, and I snap back into normal everyday living and I see the pictures, I see the photos. It's absurd. It's totally absurd. Like I get it. It's weird. I don't know. And sometimes it's weird too. I'm out in the middle of wherever in the world setting up for a cliff shot and I'm up there like hiking. I can feel everyone's nervous. I can feel everyone is nervous and I'm up there like making sense of it all. And every once in a while I have to like take a time out and be like, how in the world did I become this like cliff guy, like in skiing? in my path in life. It's so weird. You know what I mean? Like, what am I doing right now? But then I just snap back into it and I'm like, this is what you love. This is your passion and this is your path. And everyone will be nervous for you. And that's okay. That's part of that ability to get on the other side of fear, is to focus on, you know, there's a million paths with these cliffs and every one of them can hurt you except one. There's one path that cannot hurt you. And that's the path I focus on. It's very intense, but I love it. And, you know, it's something I feel in my bones and in my spirit.
And I love that, you know, you've answered your own question, you know, how did I become this big cliff guy? And it is your mental game. Nobody else that I've talked to or heard from talks like you about these sort of things. So I think that's just in profoundly impactful. That's how you do it. That's how you make this happen, is you have this mental game. And if someone's going to do something otherworldly, I think there has to be sort of a mental connection to otherworldliness, if you will. And it appears that you have that connection. And that is what differentiates you, at least from what I've heard today. And I think that's profoundly impactful. That's something our listeners should take home. You know, how do these people who are sort of larger than life and can do these things that almost nobody else can do, it is their mental game. It's their connection to that other world that we can't really understand. But because you have understanding around it, you're able to use it, manipulate it, and be with it. And that's very cool and very impressive.
Well, thanks. It's you know, something I love, and I know that it's fleeting, because you know there's only so much shelf life physically that you're going to have these moments. And my passion to chase cliffs. I love skiing. I love traveling. I love being in the mountains. I love powder. And so obviously when you're traveling around and you're seeking powder, these amazing opportunities happen. And I think people are so desensitized to the idea of like hitting 100, you know, people can jump 100 feet into water daily because there's facilities, there's static places that can happen anytime, anywhere. And so people get desensitized to that. But it's so interesting and so bizarre for people to hear that when you put snow on an angle and you're talking 15 to 20 feet of base with a continuous cycle of storms for a week, you know, putting 70 plus inches of fresh snow on top of 15 feet of snow at an angle, and then you're coming off your cliff with speed. So when you come in contact with this unbelievably soft substance in a relaxed manner, it is beyond safer than water. And it's just so strange that
people... Yeah, no surface tension.
People can see people jump 100 feet into water, and they've seen it enough now that it doesn't rattle their kind of preconceived ideas of what's possible. But what's so interesting about skiing and this path is that the conditions in the right cliffs and a safe parameter, it's so rare. If I could go out and find a good cliff to hit, like cliff jumpers into water could go find a good cliff every day, I'd be hitting 100 footers every single day. No questions asked.
I love it.
But you don't. And that's why it's so intense and so profound and so enriching and so fun, is that when you're out there enough skiing and enjoying the mountains and having a blast with your friends, suddenly those days do come upon. And suddenly you do need to seize the moment. And I think that's part of the fun. And it's part of fun too, is sharing it. Like, I've been able to get quite a few of my friends to hit their first, you know, 60 footer or 70 footer or even 100 footer, that when we're done, they're like, if I would have been with you and watched the way you went about it and the way you hit it, I would have never in a million years done it. But I was with you. I saw you. I saw how relaxed you were, and you did it right in front of me. So I had to do it. And so it's fun for me to share that with other skiers that love putting 100 days in a year too, to suddenly give them the ability or the interest, or, you know, just that timing, because it's so rare. And usually most skiers aren't, you know, like waiting for that moment. They're usually like, sweet, I'm going to go ski more powder, and more power to them. That's what you should be doing. And I do too. But every once in a while, you know, as you're doing all those things, I just love to find those moments.
When you're right, it's ephemeral, right? It's so infrequent that the conditions line up to be able to hit a 100-foot cliff that you just don't get that opportunity very often. And that makes you step up even more, right? Because it's, oh, it's today, it's now. Kind of like the way you told your first story. And I actually hit a 100-foot cliff once at Squaw Valley, Palisades Tahoe now. And after Gunnar Newquist hit it, I don't know if you remember Gunnar, he was a 100-foot guy, and he did a front flip off it. And I just watched him do it. And I thought, God, that looks like it's okay. And so I went up there and it was my turn to go. And the guy says, go on the radio. And I went and I hadn't thought it through. You know, I wasn't in the place that you were. I stayed tight in the air. And I remember it felt like I was in the air for minutes. And the ground felt like I did a mental calculation. I think it was about 100 feet, 110 feet. But in my mind, it was like, that's 180 feet. You're very far from the ground. Yeah. And I didn't come out of my tuck until it was too late. And so I didn't land flat like you're supposed to. And I had a sore back. And I remember that was the end of my big jumping cliff. but it just shows, you know, I wasn't prepared, but it was an ephemeral moment for me. Cause I realized, hey, if you're ever going to try this, this is the day. And I wish I had a little bit better mental preparation that day, which I didn't, but I was okay. I didn't get hurt. I was quite young, you know, I was early 20s. So that was great. And I read recently that at some point in your career, you'd hit 100-foot cliff every year for 10 years. Is that right?
Yeah. I think just until 3 or 4 years ago. And the last 3 or 4 years, I haven't gotten over 100, but I've been able to hit like the diving board at Targhee. And I think the last big cliff I hit was like 2015 in Whistler when I was able to do the Air Jordan.
Oh, that was ridiculous. I saw that.
I was like, 100, 185 feet. So that was, I haven't gotten over 100 feet since I think that Air Jordan.
Which is awesome I love that doesn't feel big to you because, you know, we have a mutual friend, my good friend, Owen Leeper. I've seen what you guys do. You know, we talked about the diving board at Grand Targhee. For our listeners, this thing's huge. I don't know, you know, the feet on it, but it's way too big for me or anybody, you know, that isn't a true professional in that realm. And then some of the other airs you've hit just in bounds at Jackson Hole the last couple of years is just phenomenal. And I'm curious, you know, you talked about all the different tricks that you do off big cliffs. What's your favorite cliff trick to throw?
You know, front flip, because you essentially, you know, swan dive. And when you're swan diving, you're slicing through the air body and your, you know, knees are bent at a 45 degree angle. So your skis are also slicing through the air and you're not putting any of your body at the mercy of wind. And so you can tuck over your front flip whenever you choose to, if you set your front flip right. And I, you know, through those, ever since I was a little kid doing thousands of front flips, I just innately know those mechanics that's in my bones, you know. That's for sure the best way to hit big cliffs is doing a front flip, and it's my favorite. I mentioned earlier I did a backflip off the Wolverine cliff. It was 140 feet. I've never backflipped a cliff over 50 feet, but that particular day I was up there and I was going to do a front flip again because I just done a front flip off it a month earlier. And I was out there making the in run and getting ready. And I was actually with Billy Poole. And he was like, I need to hit that with you. And I'm like,
yeah,
let's go. So we go up there and we get them all lined up and he's ready to go. He goes off first and he does a super proud straight air. And like I mentioned earlier, the day we hit that cliff, the cliff was 140 feet and he held his straight air really, you know, beautifully. And at the very last, you know, millisecond, wind did grab him a little bit too, but it wasn't over that threshold that it would affect, you know, substantially how you'd land. So he landed great, skied away like a boss, laughing. So I'm up there ready to go next. I'm going to do another front flip. And I just started having these strange full body realization or like visualizations of doing a backflip. And I didn't even think about like, oh, I should do a backflip off this. It just, all of a sudden I just kept like having these weird visualizations of doing a backflip. And I ignored the sensation. I ignored it. I was like, no, I'm doing a front flip. And I just kept having them and it was really intense. And I kept having them to the point where I was like, okay, I'm going to sit with this, you know, whatever's persisting in me right now. Like, okay, let me focus on this backflip idea. So I sat with it. And I got to the point where, again, found that supreme relaxation, supreme confidence of 100%, I'm going to do a backflip, but I'm going to be okay. And, you know, 140-foot cliff, for all of us, you know, and obviously I've seen a lot of beautiful backflips you've done, and everyone that loves doing backflips, such a fun feeling when you tilt your head back and pop, and
it's the best trick.
Have that moment. Oh, it's so fun.
So
and
fun.
So for this one, I had to be so patient with that pop.
Oh man.
Look back.
And
it lasted, but it worked out. I came around and was able to get my body in the right position. But that was the only time I've ever done a backflip, like I said, over a 50-foot cliff. And I know, you know, I'll never do that again. It was just a very strange circumstance that suddenly I wanted to do it that day. But like I was saying, with straight air, you can be exposed to the wind. A front flip, you slice through the air, you control when you tip it over. You're never at the mercy. A backflip, obviously, you're at the mercy of how well you set it. So
yes,
in my opinion, if you're going over 100 feet, like a front flip is protocol. Certainly there's some circumstances that other tricks make sense, especially if you're someone that maybe has like a really solid Misty or a D7 or something, and you know that amount of time in the air, and you're able to sort that to the point where you're 100% confident. I just think there's so many mechanics involved. I think that's why we haven't seen anybody do a Misty or a D7 off a 100-foot cliff, because there's just a lot going on through such a long period of time that can suddenly make you land in a bad way, you know?
Yeah, too much.
Because you absolutely need to land in a way that you're not going to give yourself harm, because from that height, you know, if you land in the wrong way, some really bad things can happen, you know?
Absolutely, man. No, I love that. Front flip is protocol, and you're the one that discovered that, and you're able to pass that on. I love that. And obviously, I've seen a lot of other people, including Owen, do that, and it does seem to be the way to do it. I love that, man. Today's Snow Brains podcast is brought to you by Killington. Take advantage of the longest season in the East with the Killington Spring Pass. Pay just $349 for unlimited ski and snowboard access to Killington Resort from March 18th through the end of the 21-22 season. With Killington's history of stretching the season late into May, that could be 6 weeks of prime skiing and riding. So grab your Spring Pass today before prices increase on March 18th. Learn more at Killington.com. Today's Snow Brains podcast is brought to you by A Golden State. What started from humble beginnings long before the cannabis renaissance is now California's highest quality flower. A Golden State's proprietary exotic strains are carefully curated for recreation or relaxation, sharing with friends or unwinding solo. Their artisanal whole flower is available in eighths and pre-rolls at dispensaries across California. How many avalanches have you been in?
I've only been in one. And yeah, it happened in Dry Fork near Gargoyle in the side country at Alta.
Uh-huh.
And I hit, you know, a 15-foot cliff that landed me in a chute that I was going to ski the rest of the line. And as soon as I landed up to my waist, you know, instantly released, maybe propagated 40 feet wide and, you know, up to my waist.
So whoa.
Suddenly I'm going down the chute way faster than I would have been skiing in the avalanche. And I remember just, you know, kicking and fighting to get on top of the snow. And, you know, obviously that's what you're taught and told. And when it really happens, it's not that easy. And
no.
I did though. And I got on top of the snow and it all came to a rest. And, you know, we obviously had our protocol for cameramen and the other skiers that were ready to come get me immediately. So that was refreshing. I was okay. I was on top of the snow. It was probably maybe class 3 at best. It was more like a class 2. So
wow.
It was so scary though, that the idea of being in a class 4 or 5 and bigger is just terrifying, you know, but that was the only one I've been in.
Wow. Well, I'm glad it was only that one. I'm glad you were on top. And you mentioned your knee injury and your femur injury. Have you had any other ski injuries?
I broke 2 ribs and my entire rib lining once.
Ooh, that hurts.
For people that ski the bird a lot, they call this thing the blackjack moto. It's the moto gap. You know, you probably travel 70 to 80 feet and you drop 30 to 35 feet, but you hit a cat track and you actually clear the switchback of the same cat track. Gigantic cat track gap where you clear the switchback of where it goes down again, further down the mountain.
Damn.
Yeah, it's like a rites of passage of the bird, or at least it was. First time I ever hit it, I was with a loose cannon. Some homie I definitely respect, his name is Steve Bedford, but he rolled around with like the Collins Bros and Sage and Manessi and those guys.
Oh yeah.
And he was probably the loosest cannon of the bunch, but also had a vision. His vision usually exceeded his abilities though, even though he's supremely talented, but he always had a vision. So anyway, I remember I was with him. We smoked a couple bowls and he's like, we just hit the moto gap. We should go hit it. And in my head, I was like, well, I don't know if I'm ready for that because, you know, that thing is real deal and it's massive. And
right.
I was like, well, let's go look at it. So we ski down there, and as you're going down this run, you need to like ski up the run off the cat track, you know, to sidestep way up there to get speed to hit this thing. And this guy Bedford, he lines me up wrong. He lines me up wrong.
No.
But again, this was before my femur surgery.
Okay.
So I was just like, whatever. This is like, I got it. Yeah. And he lines me up. I hit this thing the way I hit it that day, definitely 120 feet with like a 50 foot drop.
Oh God.
And I came up perfectly short.
No.
I landed on the last 4 feet of that cat track.
No.
And I remember I was in the air. And I just knew it instantly. As soon as I got in the air, I was like, I'm not going to clear it.
No.
And I was like, well, do I put it to his side? And there's this guy, Todd Loveless, the year before that did put it to his side on the smaller part where you're supposed to hit it. And he broke both his legs.
Ooh.
So I'm in the air. I'm like, no, don't put it to your side because you don't want to break both your legs. I'm like, just put it straight to your feet. Like just stomp it basically is like what I told myself. I'm like,
whoa,
just stay in a body position that is strong, you know?
Right.
So I hit boom, both my knees slam into my chest and
ooh,
I spring off the cat, double front flip.
No.
Air came off. My beanie came off. It was
most
ragdoll of all time. I double front flip ragdoll in the air. And then I wet noodle slide down the snow, and you know, there's a crowd that had formed to watch this.
Jesus.
And they all were like, we were 100% sure you were dead, dude.
Oh my God.
Well, we could feel the ground shake from where we were standing up on the cat track. So they ski down to me, and my lungs, like my ribs, everything just felt like it was on fire, you know. And anyway, I ended up breaking the two ribs and my entire rib cage. Like if you actually feel my rib cage now, it's actually, there's like this bump in it because I broke the entire rib cage. Though, and then another year, a couple years earlier at Berthoud Pass, I was doing the extremes there in like 2001.
Colorado.
I hit this great cliff, the badass extremes. Anyway, I stomped and I'm skiing out and my binding came off and I had a spectacular crash.
Ooh.
And I spiral fractured my tib fib.
Jeez. Oh man.
So I had a good, you know, 5-6 year period there where I had quite a few season ending injuries, and still none of it really shook that mentality of like everything will work out until I had that femur surgery that finally resonated that I needed to change my ways with the way I approached things.
Wow, man. Thank you for those stories. Though that is nuts, man. I'm just imagining your gloves flying off. You hit so hard.
Oh, yeah.
And doing a double front flip. The footage of that would be terrifying, but legendary.
And I'm just starting to grow my hair out, and my hair elastic came out in my hair.
Oh my God, that's nuts. Well, let's jump on that. Let's jump on that really quick, because I heard that you have maybe knee length hair sometimes. Do you still have really, really long hair?
Yeah, it's definitely like almost past my ass. It's really long.
Nice. And why do you like to have long hair like that?
You know, when I was in college, my sister is a hairstylist and she'd always cut my hair. So I had normal guy length hair and I was just kind of used to her cutting it. And then suddenly she got married and moved to Portland. And I was like, well, she's the only one who knows how to cut my hair. And then the winter went by and my hair started getting long. And then the whole summer went by, I didn't see my sister. And I just kept putting my sunglasses on and like flipping my hair up to keep it out of my face. And then the whole next winter went by, obviously just my hair underneath the beanie. And I was like, well, I guess I'm growing out my hair. So as that progressed, now, you know, I jokingly say that I feel like long hair is like an extension of your nervous system. So it definitely helps with my abilities with cliffs. But
like Samson,
I think the actual plan, the master plan, and like deep down subconsciously, it will be at some point, I think, in the next maybe even we'll say 2 to 4 years, I'm gonna cut it into the world's greatest mullet.
Yeah, the world's longest for sure.
Yes, and I got a plan for it. It's gonna be amazing, and there's a Camaro involved. There, the goal of when you Google mullets, I will pop up number one because I will mention about two glorious years in around the 09s, 10s. If you Googled neck beard, I came up first for about 2 years. So I have the track to achieve this. So it's another goal of mine.
And you know, you've done it. You've done it once. You can do it again. I love that, man. That's great.
Yeah.
What's your favorite ski movie of all time?
Ooh. And three-way tie is High Life TGR, probably around 2004. And then Global Storming MSP.
Yeah.
It was the opening double song segment of Seth.
Yes.
And that entire movie was just so fire. So Hessian, so sick. All I Can from Sherpa's just completely flipped the script. I mean, hands down is one of the GOAT films, you know?
I agree. Absolutely. What's your favorite book or books?
A Short History of Nearly Everything by Bill Bryson. That book's amazing. It just really dumbs down just about every topic. Chemistry, physics, geology, you know, your own body composition, all the way down to the cosmos. It's just such a fascinating read to get these nuts and bolts of everything and how fascinating, you know, life is. It's an amazing book.
Because I just read that you received the George Mallory Lifetime Achievement Award. And George Mallory was the famous British mountaineer who was obsessed with Mount Everest. And he tried to climb it a few times. He may have summited, but he definitely died in the process. And he famously answered a reporter's question once who was asking, hey, why are you trying to climb this mountain? And he said famously, because it's there. Or maybe infamously. I love that. So what is the George Mallory Lifetime Achievement Award? And how did you come to be in possession of it?
You know, it was a total surprise. And I think it's kind of funny throughout the years, I've been fortunate enough and super grateful to have, you know, had some cool ski awards. And I think this one to me was really special because it kind of recognized everything I'd done in skiing, but in the same breath, they really mentioned Cirque Series. And Cirque Series, yes. You know, it's been a way that I've really enjoyed giving back to be inclusive about the high alpine because I love being in the mountains. I love what it feels like spiritually to be in the mountains. And I created the Cirque Series to be very inclusive to all abilities, to challenge people to get up to high mountain peaks.
Tell us really quick what the Cirque Series is.
You know, I think people now are pretty fluent with the idea of what an ultra is. And usually an ultra is a 100-mile race through really rugged mountain peaks for 100 miles, you know, going 20, 25,000 vert. So it's a very elite experience in the mountains that, you know, people have spent their lives crafting the abilities to do it, get to partake in those adventures. So I call the Cirque Series a mini ultra. So all our races go up to those same rugged high peaks. Every race summits at least one high alpine iconic peak, if not four. And they're all under 7 miles, usually have an average of 3,000 vert. So yeah, it's fun because we still have the elites come out and for them, it's kind of a walk in the park, but I architect the race is to be a direct, you know, pretty intuitive path to the summit. So for me, I'm used to, you know, bootpacking on a ridge or skinning up routes that typically are not going into those convex or concave areas. So you're staying on ridges and going straight up into the high alpine to ski. So that's the same way I've built all the Cirque Series courses. We have 7 races. You know, we're going to Switzerland this year. We actually have a race in Engelberg.
Congrats.
Oh, thanks. And Alyeska, Alaska, Snowbird, Brighton, Alta, and A Basin, Colorado. Wow. They're all selling out and bringing in just these amazing walks of life. I think that's what's been so fun to me, is to see a group of, like, you know, a family show up where the grandson, the dad, and the grandpa are all doing the race together, and standing next to them in the start gate is an Olympian or, wow, you know, the number one ranked mountain runner in the world. So to have one race make sense for all those walks of life and for everyone to come together and enjoy a day in the mountains and to be in an environment that you can meet, you know, friends, make friends, your significant other. I've seen people get married from meeting at the Cirque Series, but the Mallory Award in that same breath, like I said.
Yeah. Thank you for going back to it.
Yeah. They were like, we really want to recognize and, you know, acknowledge what you're doing with the Cirque Series and you know, what you're contributing to providing such amazing experiences for people in the mountains with your races. So that was really special for me to have this kind of shout out for my ski career, which I appreciate. And I've had some amazing awards in my ski career, like the X Games and Powder Reader Poll and all that kind of stuff, which is so fun for me. But it was amazing to get a shout out and recognition for, you know, it feels like a new project I've been working on now for 5 years. Or no, I guess it's 6 years now, but I love it. So that was very cool.
I'm very impressed with this award, but even more impressed, as they were, with the Cirque Series, man. It's amazing. So you created the Cirque Series. It's been quite successful. There's a lot more probably going to happen in the future. Do you plan to continue expanding it? How many races do you think you might be able to have in a year?
Well, you know, I had to pump the brakes a couple of years ago because I've had quite a few iconic mountains reach out to me saying they want a Cirque Series at their mountain.
Oh, great.
And me being, you know, a very ambitious, optimistic person wants to jump on every opportunity. But my, you know, the reality is, you know, throwing a truly rugged world-class race series, you know, we're very unique. There's a lot of other standalone races in the world, but definitely in the United States, we're the only mountain running race series that exists. And I think we're setting a standard for what a mountain race series should be.
Nice.
I think our standalone races can stand up against any of the very well-established, respected races, and it's reflected in who's attending our races. But anyway, my goal is to become very efficient in my production. And I want to focus on the 7 races that we do have right now, to the point that when we do want to expand in like maybe 2 or 3 years to more mountains, then it's turnkey. We can be very efficient because, you know, it's been a big, big lesson in production. You know, my whole life, even like when I was in high school, I would have, you know, 2 or 3 kegers at my house, and always understood the mechanics of like what it takes to have a good time in a social setting. And in college, I was like the social chairman of my fraternity. And I've always enjoyed, it's almost intuitive to me, event production. So after having a previous company called Discreet Clothing that I sold last year, which I'm very excited about, I was able to split off Cirque Series and sell Discreet.
Whoa, congrats.
Thank you. And from the 10-year lesson of running a business with Discreet and my innate kind of intuitive sense to event production and my love for mountain running and being in the mountains, it was really fun for me to be like, okay, I'm going to nail this Cirque Series project. I know exactly what I'm doing. And it's just been fun to see what I wanted to do and do it. And
vision.
The bottom line is just sharing the mountains with more people, being in those special places that I hold dear to my heart, and to be in them year round is so fun for me because it keeps me in shape. It keeps me mentally engaged. You know, I'm at my capacity throughout the whole summer because I race direct the entire series. And we're getting pretty serious in the mountain running space, and we're kind of establishing ourselves as the, you know, the premier mountain running series in the United States, and you know, Europeans are coming out to do it now, and we're going to Europe to produce a race this year. And it's very fun to have that sense of responsibility to the people that come to these races to make sure I produce great events.
I am very impressed. I love your cerebral approach to all of these things that you do and that you do so well, because I think that's such a good example for us is, you know, really getting into the mindset, really thinking things out, really having strategy is key. And you mentioned Discreet and we got to talk about it. So Discreet Clothing, you know, I didn't know you'd sold it. That's, you know, congratulations on that. But it's, you started this clothing company that was, I think, focused on headwear primarily, and it's been very successful. And I got to know, you know, why and when did you start Discreet?
Well, I was in college and I was going to school full time. I was, you know, just starting to pursue the idea of being a professional skier. And I was working, you know, four nights a week in a sports bar downtown Salt Lake. And as things started kind of coming together for me on the skiing side of things, at the same time, I saw a few of kind of like the biggest names in skiing at the time were, you know, quote unquote, getting older and kind of getting brushed aside by the industry, which I was tripped out about because I grew up doing lots of skateboarding and all the icons, all the OGs were always a part of the culture, supported by companies, which is the right thing to do. Obviously, back at that time in skiing, it was all racing and you know, corporate driven. There weren't a lot of individuals that were driving anything as far as the ownership was concerned. So all these people that meant so much to the extreme skiing scene and the free ride scene, as they aged, suddenly they're getting brushed aside and kind of struggling with their next steps in life. And I remember just seeing that with some of these heroes of mine and seeing them struggle with their next steps. And I was like, wow, note to self, like, no matter how great things work out on this goal I have of being a professional skier, there's obviously a shelf life and you need to have something else going on that you can build during your ski career so that when that shelf life does expire, you have something else going on. And I've always loved being creative. When I was like a little kid, I had my own alphabet that I had a key. So I'd write these big notes to my parents and they'd have to use the key because it was my own language.
Code.
Yeah. Yeah. And I always remember just having like, I mean, I always make commercials with my friends. I was always just thinking. So I was already trying to think of like brand names, even in high school. And I'd always, anyway, it just really became real in college. I was like, sweet, I'm going to start a brand. And that's kind of where the inspiration was kind of, you know, it was already kind of in me. And then the other, it got propelled by that sense of, you should probably figure something out that you can grow along with your ski career.
That was very intuitive of you to have that realization that, hey, I need to have something to fall back on or just something going on in the background or in the foreground, just as my ski career is inevitably going to end. And I love that. It's very Tolkien of you to have your own alphabet. That's so cool. And so you started Discreet, you know, as early as college, which is very impressive and intelligent to do. Why do you think it got popular though? That's the hard part. What made it popular?
I think same thing. I knew I couldn't afford, you know, a full on ad campaign in Powder Magazine or Freeskier or anything. So I knew some of the editors from my ski career and I would call them and be like, hey, how about I make Powder 1,000 branded Powder hats that are super cool. And you guys trade me an ad campaign for the retail value of these 1,000 hats.
Smart.
So I did that with, you know, Freeride World Tour. I did it with so many, like MSP. I just did things like that where I try to think outside the box and try to be resourceful. And I think I was able to put together enough of like my peers and my friends that were wearing it and put together those cool ad campaigns. And, you know, soon enough, the beanies and the logos are showing up in all the cool movies. And it was all, you know, it was part of my plan. It was my intent, but I think it was just kind of all a natural extension of all the connections I'd made as a skier and then just having a way to express myself in a way that I could be a part of that culture, not just only as a skier. So it was very fun to put together ad campaigns and the website and events and be included in the scene. And then obviously having to learn how to navigate supply chain, accounting, and payroll, and all the logistics that go into like, you know, brick and mortar ability for your sales program. And then through that all, learn how to be an efficient company. It was very same thing. I rolled into that with a, you know, I was very determined to give it a name, but suddenly as things started happening, I had to quickly figure out how to run a business. And all the while I'm skiing 150 days a year.
Wow.
And you know, had interns or maybe one or two employees, you know, those first 8-9 years, the last 3 or 4 years, I was able to have 3 or 4 employees that kind of held things down, and I steered ships in the background. But
nice,
you know, for a good decade, I was wearing so many hats, having to make so many decisions, which was great. I made a lot of great decisions, and I made plenty of bad ones. But yeah, I learned an invaluable, you know, real life, how do you run a business? So that those things that I learned from that experience, and to be able to be a part of ski culture through Discrete, was so soul enriching. Yes. And so fun and so challenging, you know, because you have to be creative in so many ways with product development, product design, and then your campaigns. And then you had to really have your nuts and bolts about you to put together sales programs and be on time with supply chain and your sales samples and your trade shows. Because at the height of Discrete, pre direct to customer, like pre digital age, you know, probably around 2013 or so, we were in 150 plus stores.
Whoa.
REI, yeah, REI, Backcountry, Zumiez, Evo. And I had, you know, we're going to OR, Outdoor Retailer, and ISPO over in Munich.
Oh yeah, the big one. So
it's 7 sales reps in the US, 13 international distributors.
Wow.
And I was running the whole damn show for the most part.
Wow.
And I designed all the product and did all the supply chain.
Holy shit.
And the whole time I'm, you know, skiing my ass off and hitting 100 footers every year is crazy times.
And juggling a professional skiing career. That is phenomenal, man. I'm throttled that you had that vision so young to start a company so young. And, you know, obviously doing that with your professional skiing career. You know, I went into the skiing, you know, ski careers myself right out of college. And then, you know, I didn't have anything cerebral for about 10 years, 9 years, until I started working and I had founded Snowbrains. And it was such a relief to me. I needed that outlet. I didn't have that for so long. And it was huge for me. So that you had the foresight to have that right from the beginning, I am jealous of. Because that is what I'm hearing from you, is that has been a really fulfilling part of your life. You know, almost more so than the skiing in a lot of ways, and very complementary to it, especially since the industry of your clothing and your skiing overlap, and you're leveraging your connections, leveraging your ski career to help your business as well, is so, you know, so forward thinking. You know, I wish I had done that myself. I think still kind of on cloud nine. We're about to be, Snowbrains is about 10 years old now, and it's just so fun. You know, people talk to me about selling it. I'm just not ready yet because I don't have another plan like your badass Cirque series. That's so cool. And then I want to touch on one more thing just to show people what a freaking business person you are. Tell me a little bit about Blake Broncos. If I understand this right, you love Broncos, Ford Broncos, old ones, and you restore them and you've made it into a business as well. Tell me a little bit about this, please.
Oh yeah, man. Thanks for bringing it up. COVID hit and quarantine went down and, you know, shutdowns happened. So obviously there I am in event production. And so suddenly, like, you know, we had to cancel our entire summer of races in 2020.
Monkey wrench.
And so I'm so at capacity in the summers producing the races. And suddenly, not having my race schedule, I noticed that Ford Bronco was coming out, or I noticed Ford was coming out with their new Bronco. And my first car I got on my 16th birthday, I got a 1978 Ford Bronco the day I turned 16. So there I am. I got time. And I was going to go on this big hike this day. Suddenly we didn't go on the hike. And I was like, just nerding out on the new Bronco. And I just started, boom. I'm like, I wonder what's going on with the 78, 79s. Cause that's the only 2 years they made that particular body style. So most people, they think of a classic Ford Bronco. They think of like the small boxy ones, the 1966 to 1977, which is called like the first generation Bronco.
Right.
It was that same body style. They made it for 11 years. Iconic. Part of the classic Bronco landscape. 78, 79s were the only 2 years they made the ones I love. And so I started Googling those 2 years And they've always been kind of in this price range, because I every once in a while just Google those years just to check them out. I noticed they were kind of going up in cost because this new Bronco coming out. Suddenly the Bronco world was kind of going bonkers because Ford announced they're coming out with a new Ford Bronco. And yeah. I was like, huh, you know what? I'm like, I should get another, you know, 1978 or 79 Bronco, just a project truck. And it'll be fun. I'll just have it. I can work on it slowly. It'll just be a really fun thing to have, because I'm like, if I don't buy one right now, I'm probably going to get priced out in a few years. I could just tell there's kind of some momentum going on in the Ford Bronco scene because of Ford announcing their 2021 Bronco. So I just completely immersed myself in the Bronco, like classic Broncos for a couple of weeks, but I was determined to find one I wanted to buy. So anyway, I could not find the right one. They were all like, you know, it just wasn't happening. I couldn't find the right one. They're either too beat up or they're too expensive. And finally this one I found in a Craigslist in Sacramento.
Nice.
It was way over budget, but it was also underpriced. So I was like, well, I should find a way to buy this, because I know from an investment perspective, I know I can buy this Bronco and drive for however long I want it and 100% be able to sell it for what I bought it for, if not a little bit more. Because I'm like, it's over budget, but this guy is selling it for too little. I just knew it. So I actually hit the guy up, and it was a truck that this dad had built kind of, you know, as a project with his son throughout high school. And the kid was going off to college and he wanted something more economical. And I was like, yeah, sounds like a good idea. Like, I'm like thinking in the back of my head, like, kid, you're blowing it. This should be a truck in college, you know?
Yeah, this would be the car. And
so I'm like, yeah, it sounds good. And I was like, well, all right, what if I trade you, you know, like a pair of Icelandic skis and maybe a spider jacket or something to maybe knock off $1,000. So he comes back the next day and he's like, hey, my son said that'd be great. So let's do it.
Nice.
So they knocked the price down a little bit more. I threw in some outdoor gear. And anyway, here I am shipping, you know, this cherry all black 1979 Bronco to my house.
Yes.
And as it's arriving, I'm going down like the Instagram rabbit hole of like classic Bronco like pages. So because there's lots of guys out there doing Broncos, but most of them focus on the first gens. But I found a few guys that like these 78, 79s. So I started talking to them. I showed them the pictures of the one I'm getting. And they're like, hey, the color of your bumpers and your side mirrors, it means they're, you know, a pretty rare version of a Bronco. So I started learning all these like factory specs that it, you know, came with like rare little things you could check off the list that made the trucks more valuable. So then I started nerding out even more once I started talking to these guys that were way into it and restoring them. And they're like, dude, you might have like a really rare one that came with these decals originally from the factory called chromatic decals.
Ooh, jackpot.
Yeah, they're like, get your VIN. You go to this website, type in your VIN. You pay like $20. In 2 weeks, you'll get like this factory report card. I send it off. I get the report back, and I had like a Mickey Mantle. It not only had the stripes originally, it came with this other thing called a freewheeling package, which had all these extras. And then it was a trailer special, meaning it had this decal. I could nerd out on what it all means. It's not important, but the what's important is that suddenly I had this rare Bronco, and I slowly started studying the report card of what the factory specs were, and I brought it back to original. I put the stripes back on it. I got everything mechanically back to original and made this thing really cherry.
Smart.
And while I was doing it, I started getting offers all the time driving it out in public or on my Instagram page. I started blake.bronco. I started a whole Instagram page, and I would get all these offers for it for considerably more than I'd spent on it. And I was like, huh, this is interesting. So then I just kept my eyes open. And like I said, that whole summer I wasn't producing races. So suddenly I was just nerding out in the Bronco scene and crash course on all things 1978, 79 Broncos. And I kept my eyes open and ended up finding more rare versions that the sellers weren't quite aware that they had a rare version. They just thought they had a, you know, pretty decent Bronco they were selling for the right price. And they just didn't know that it had all these original factory things that it came with. So I started buying these Broncos and restoring them back to original and selling them. So the easiest thing to compare it to, buying a house that's like kind of nice, then you make it super nice and sell it, right?
Oh yeah.
So that's what I started doing. And in the last, you know, 19, 20 months now, I'm on my ninth Bronco.
No way. I was just going to ask you how many. I did not guess it was going to be nine. Wow.
Yes, yeah, so on my ninth. And along the way, I've gone by Blake Bronco. And I've gone to national Bronco shows. I've won Best in Show.
Really?
79s.
Holy yep.
shit. 2 years in a row, I got first place. This year, I got second place.
Wow. And congrats. I'm a co-host.
Thanks, man. I'm co-host for the Ford Bronco Talk podcast as well. And I got sponsored by Ford.
Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah. So all these great things have happened by with the Broncos. And it's been very fun for me because it's been, I'm Blake Bronco in the Bronco world. So I can go be amongst the Ford Bronco scene with my 78, 79. And I'm Blake Bronco.
I love that.
It's really fun to do something that has nothing to do with outdoors. Because even Cirque Series, you know, there's still a lot of overlap with, you know, my professional skiing. And
yeah, you're in the mountains.
And yeah, but, you know, I also try to produce those races that people can come enjoy them. And obviously it has nothing to do with me. They're just really fun races. But it's different with the Blake Bronco because with Cirque Series and skiing, it's still the outdoor industry. So suddenly I'm in like, you know, classic Ford Bronco industry, completely anonymous as Blake Bronco. So it's been this very fun project to just be so immersed in that culture. It has nothing to do with the outdoor industry, which has been very fun for me.
I love how hard you just nerded out on Broncos, man. I love it. I think if I'm not mistaken, Blake's your middle name. So that was a great strategy on that too. Wow. How fun, man. Yeah. Congrats to all that. I love that you're winning Bronco shows and you're co-hosting podcasts about Broncos. And I feel like the sky's kind of the limit for you on that one too. So that must feel really just engaging and rewarding. Congrats. That's so fun.
Thanks, man. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. So let's just a couple more questions. So moving to Colorado, you are a born and bred Salt Lake City, Utah person, if I understand that right. And you've recently moved to Colorado. So tell us a little bit about, you know, why you moved there and how you're liking your new state.
You know, in 2019 at the A Basin Cirque Series race, the last mile of the race, this girl passed me and instantly I was like, I had a conversation with that girl 5 years earlier in Silverton, Colorado. And I always remembered her.
Ah,
even though we never talked ever since then. And I was like, I know that's her. I know it. Anyway, fast forward to now, we're married.
Oh, wow. Congrats again.
Yeah. We just got married a couple weeks ago at Alta.
Oh, that's great.
And so she's a purebred Colorado girl. Kind of, I'm a purebred Salt Lake guy. And throughout quarantine, I ended up being home based out of her house. I was going to travel a lot throughout quarantine. I had a bunch of trips planned. Suddenly we're just quarantined together and kind of fast tracked our whole relationship in a great way. You know, it obviously made things apparent that we wanted to really move forward with things, which was awesome.
Quarantine made or broke relationships.
Exactly. So it really fast tracked us in the most amazing ways. We spent so much time in the mountains and just completely clicked in so many other ways. And it's amazing. But I said, suddenly I'm like, well, I guess I'm living in Golden, Colorado with you.
Nice.
So there I am. But we were like, this is awesome. We're doing this. It's game on. So anyway, we built a cabin we live in up on the other side of Hoosier Pass, kind of near Breckenridge in a middle of nowhere area called Jefferson, Colorado. And we have 3 acres and 2 dogs and a cat and 2 chickens. And we both travel quite a bit. And when we are home, it's just our own little slice of heaven. And we have a hot tub and a sauna. And it's just a 1200 square foot home with a big garage. And it's perfect for what we have going on. And, you know, had a home in Salt Lake that I sold My office and my warehouse is still in Salt Lake. Obviously, so many friends and incredible skiing and roots are still in Salt Lake, so I still go there quite often. Danielle, my wife and I were actively looking for another cabin to buy in Big Cottonwood Canyon so we can split our time between this cabin we have here in Jefferson, Colorado, and in Big Cottonwood. So
that would be
my great. Utah roots still strong enough. We got to get something going on back in Utah for sure.
That's great. Well, thank you for sharing all that. So you are an ambassador for Protect Our Winters and the Conservation Land Foundation. And you know, I think climate change is just the most pivotal, you know, I don't even know what to call it because it's everything, right? It's just the most pivotal issue of our lifetimes. And I'm curious, what evidence of climate change have you seen in your lifetime?
You know, I think that's the hard thing about climate change is that the go-to response is, you know, winters that aren't, you're just worried about the future if there's still going to be winters. But I think what we're all seeing is that it's one extreme or the other. It's either an extremely good winter or it's an extremely dry winter. And I think that is going to become more and more common. And I think that, you know, you look at more and more severe droughts, more floods, more fires, like all these things are happening at a more frequent and every year record setting level. So I think that these extremes of either one way or another is already kind of commonplace. And I think that for me, being a part of POW or Conservation Lands Foundation is that, like you said, it's a huge topic.
Huge.
There's a lot of good information, misinformation, a lot of opinion, a lot of negativity. Like there's so many things that can be attached to even saying the word POW. And I think that at the end of the day, POW is an excellent resource for education. And that's why I was gravitated towards POW is that,
yes,
like you said, I was like, man, this is such a big topic that I don't want to be blind. I want to know the nuts and bolts of the science. I want to know the nuts and bolts of the policy at a state, federal level. Like I want to know what's happening. Like I want to just know. So if I can at least know, then maybe every once in a while I can contribute to the conversation, whether it's in my personal conversations or be a part of a larger campaign or think of things on my own. Because it's such a gigantic topic, it's such a mystery. Obviously, the Earth, the cosmos, everything is such a mystery. Everything's mysterious. Everything's unpredictable. No one really knows what's going on. But when you can sit down and check out the legitimate scientists that are part of the resources that POW is connecting to and all these goals that the Conservation Lands Foundation have for land conservation, like it's just really easy to have clarity in such a topic that does not have a lot of clarity. There's so much a cloud of mystery about it all. So I just find that those two organizations and many other ones that are awesome, those two in particular to me have provided me clarity that I can at least have the education. Bottom line is what really attracted me to those organizations. And like I said, if you can at least have that baseline education, then maybe every once in a while you can contribute to that conversation publicly or personally.
And what do you think has to happen to see real change in the fight against climate change?
To me, the bigger goal is the next level. Like there's nothing wrong with flying in a helicopter. There's nothing wrong with flying in an airplane. It's what fuels them.
Right.
Sustainable energy. Like obviously to have an infrastructure the globe over is going to take a very bumpy road to get there. And so, you know, when people just call out the faults in solar energy and the ability to scale it or electric cars and the ability to scale it, it's just unfair because we're at the infancy of that infrastructure. It's where we start.
I agree.
The path is sustainable energy and we're starting it now. And there's many, many flaws and that's part of that path.
Fantastic. Thank you for that. Last question. What is next? What's next for you in your journey, Julian?
I think I mentioned earlier, I'm always curious and I think I'm still very passionate about skiing and being in the outdoors. And I probably pretty boring answer, but I'm still very much passionate about my current path. And I feel like who knows what's going to be a part of that path. Maybe cliffs, maybe more Broncos, maybe both, maybe you know, 40 race Circ Series within 4 or 5 years, or, you know, maybe status quo for another 5. I don't know, man, but I'm curious, and I love being in the mountains, and life is super cool. I feel like I'm just getting started.
It's clear you're not going to let any opportunities pass you by. Julian, that's all I got for you. Do you have any other thoughts you'd like to share here at the end of the show?
Oh, I will say, earlier when you asked about the baseball card stats, I forgot to mention how unique the experience was of getting the other world record, which was the biggest cliff hit in a competition. Which was at the 2007 US Free Skiing Nationals. I hit a 140-foot cliff.
I was there in that comp, and I saw you do it. Continue.
Awesome.
The smokestack, or near the smokestack, or something like that. I forget the name.
Well, no, that's what people get tripped up on. Smokestack is like a 30-foot cliff that is way lookers left, way down the venue in Silver Fork.
Which is kind of a normal feature, right?
Yeah, tons of people hit that. So the thing I hit, it was like literally the spaceship UFO disc that is Silver Fox, which separates Silver Fox over to Great Scott. Go on. Crash top of the UFO, like directly underneath the tram cables. But I could go on and on about the miracle of circumstances that led up to me being able to do that. But the unique thing about that one was that I'm used to hitting cliffs in the backcountry with my small number of people in my crew in a very quiet environment.
Right.
And to be able to take myself into that headspace that I need to be in, of that calm, present kind of meditative space, I did it. But then when I was done with the cliff, I, you know, suddenly was bombarded by these like piercing sounds of applause, you know, like it sounded, I thought suddenly drained the 3-pointer to win the NBA finals. All of a sudden, you're in a competition right now. That's right.
I was one of the ones screaming.
Amazing that you were there, man. That was so fun to be able to have that kind of a moment during a contest, and to obviously share that with so many more people than I'm used to. That was very unique. So I thought I'd throw that in because I forgot to mention that earlier.
I hugely appreciate you adding that, because I wanted to talk about that too, because I was there. That was my introduction to you as a skier, because I just remember asking people, who the fuck was that? What the hell was that? Because I think I'd actually heard of you, but I didn't really know, you know, what that experience would look or seem like. And that was absolutely mind-blowing, man. So that was the first time I ever saw you in person. You were literally flying through the air for 140 feet.
Love it. All I got to say is I think Snowbrains is awesome, and I love what you're contributing to the outdoor space, and I'm honored to be on the show, and thank you for all you do.
Well, thank you so much. Julian, it was great talking with you today. I really appreciate you being here. You're clearly one smart motherfucker. Have a great rest of your day, and I hope that we get to ski together soon.
I like it, man. I'll see you on the slope soon.
Thank you so much for listening to the Snowbrains podcast. If you liked this podcast, please share with your friends and family, and please subscribe. To find out more about Snowbrains, please visit us at snowbrains.com. You can also find us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at Snowbrains. Today's Snowbrains podcast is brought to you by Killington. Big mountain skiing and riding meet small town charm at Vermont's Pico Mountain. Ski or ride Pico and save up to 40% off the ticket window rate when you purchase online in advance. Cancellations are always easy too, so save money and skip the line at the ticket window. Purchase your tickets today at picomountain.com/tickets. Today's Snowbrains podcast is brought to you by A Golden State. Find the perfect headspace for euphoric enjoyment. A Golden State is not a brand or a place. It's a state of being. This episode of the Snowbrains podcast was edited by Jared White. Music by Chad Crouch. And I'm your host, producer, and creator, Miles Clark.